Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is a good friend, Massachusetts State Senator Adam G. Hines. Senator Hines is a Democrat and was elected to the Massachusetts Senate in 2016, represents the largest geographic territory in the legislature, comprised of 52 western communities situated across Berkshire, Hampshire, Franklin, and Hampden counties. He serves as the Senate Chair of the Joint Committee on Tourism, Arts, and Cultural Development, which is very important to the Berkshires, I can tell you that, and the Senate Vice Chair of the Joint Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies. He's a member of several other policy committees with jurisdiction over matters of importance throughout western Massachusetts, higher education, housing, mental health, substance abuse and recovery, and intergovernmental affairs. Senator Hines also serves as the Senate co-chair of the Rural Caucus and is an active member of the Gateway Cities Regional Schools and Regional Transit Authority caucuses. He was raised in Buckland, attended Mohawk Trail Regional High School, where his mother was a librarian and his Vietnam veteran father was a schoolteacher. He attended Wesleyan University and then studied international law and negotiation at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. We'll talk with Senator Hines about all of this and much more, but first, welcome, Senator Adam Hines.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're a bit of an enigma. For those people who don't know you, you tend to not keep much hair on your head.
That's right.
Is there a philosophical...
Highly overrated.
Is there a philosophical reason for that?
Well, you know, I will say that we didn't want to rock the boat. I had big shoes to fill, and my predecessor also was follically challenged. I am very proud to announce that I wore an original Chartok WAMC hat today to the studio to cover my head. This one that you bestowed upon me when I was going door to door this time last summer.
I gave you one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it has your sweat stains and everything. It's great.
Yeah. No, I mean, I notice you've gotten smarter since that time.
Not a coincidence.
So I guess the first question is, tell us a little about your boyhood.
Huh. I'm wanting to make references to The Jerk and all these other things, but I, you know, grew up in a small town, right? And
sure.
And I suppose my first exposure to things like politics and public service was through my uncle, who was a state representative in Connecticut, and really used that as a route for going to issues of social justice, and decided to get out because he was too good old boy networky. And so, you know, that was a big part of my childhood, being around his work. And then, you know, ultimately, as I was going through school, I think I realized that I wanted to go bigger and bigger and bigger, and ultimately ended up at the United Nations for about 10 years before coming back home.
What did you do with the United Nations?
So I was a political officer and spent about 4 years in Iraq in the Green Zone.
Were you a spy?
That is often the first question. You know, interestingly, Iraqis often said, bring the American. And I think, you know, part of them thought that at the time I had, he must have the ear of George W. Bush or, you know, something else. And so, nevertheless, it was 4 years at that point working on the Constitution drafting process. And then I went back to work on Arab-Kurd negotiations over disputed internal boundaries in the north of the country.
Then so you went, were a spy?
we were working the ground.
Political officers.
That's right. That's right. We saw firsthand, quite frankly, what was happening in Mosul at the time and this, mm-hmm. this fault line from Syria to Iran. And then went to 2 years living in Jerusalem, working on the Middle East peace process.
And how'd you do? Who'd you do that with?
Also United Nations. And so a member of the Quartet, which, as you probably know, is the U.S., Russia, EU, and the United Nations working to move towards talks, often unsuccessfully. And so essentially that was 2 years of dealing with the crisis of the day. You know, a ceasefire out of Gaza or, you know, problems in the West Bank or, you know, you name it. Honestly, it was probably in Jerusalem when I decided, you know what, I don't like moving every 2 years. My parents aren't getting any younger. I want to make my way back to Western Mass. And so I joined the Syria team based in New York at UN headquarters, first working on the political process there, air quotes, and then ultimately working to remove Syria's chemical weapons program, apparently not all of it.
So you went to Wesleyan, right?
Correct.
Why'd you go there?
Honestly, I was playing baseball at the time, and they were national runners-up in Division III baseball, and I felt like, geez, this is a great place to play baseball and get a great education, and so it was a no-brainer for me.
Did you ever think of going to the bigs?
God, that was my dream up until about junior year in college, and then I realized, you know what, I can't hit an 85-mile-an-hour fastball, let alone 90.
Were you a Red Sox fan?
Still am.
Yeah.
Diehard.
Did all of this training, political science at Wesleyan?
Government and sociology, yeah. Ultimately.
Training at Wesleyan, did that prepare you for the intricacies of the Massachusetts State House?
You know, I'd say it's a broader education that involves how you're interacting with people. And so I will say it's true that focusing on sociology, you know, look, day to day, we're grappling with what are the dynamics that we're trying to contend with from a policy perspective and otherwise. And so, yeah, I would say it absolutely did play a role.
So how did you get named as a freshman senator to this incredibly important committee in the Berkshires, which is tourism?
Yeah. First of all, I asked for it. And the good news about the Massachusetts Senate, State Senate, is every senator chairs a committee. There are 40 of us, and Democrats are in the majority. And so every one of the 34 Democrats chairs a committee. And so we had to put forward proposals. And as you emphasized in the introduction, it is absolutely critical for our lifestyle, our quality of life, our economy. And so being right there in the middle of it was a priority for me.
So it was very interesting to me because at one point, some brainiac got the idea of putting a prison in Berkshire County, where I think Kripalu is now. I wouldn't swear to it, but I think that's where it was supposed to be. And we all argued. I wrote lots of columns and said, what are you doing? You know, this is where we live. You're going to drive tourism away. Mm. So tourism really has become the mantra of the Berkshires. I mean, Tanglewood, the Red Lion Inn, you name it.
It's amazing. And it's one of our top three industries. Professor Shepherd of Williams College does these economic impact studies. One of them points out that over $100 million in revenue comes to the county as a result of tourism and arts and culture. And so it's vital. We've seen it revitalize our downtowns. All you have to do is look at North Adams, where we now have the world's largest contemporary art museum in MassMoCA with its recent expansion. And similarly with Pittsfield, Barrington Stage, and Colonial Theater from the Berkshire Theater Group. And as a result, you see a $15 million investment in a boutique hotel and down the line. And so it is an engine for growth. And so we need to protect it and promote it.
You know, look, I'll be honest with you. I think that the Massachusetts legislature sometimes has its unseemly moments.
I'm shocked. Yeah.
So here you are working on policy in the United Nations, Wesleyan graduate, you're probably a spy, but we don't really know, and doing all this stuff. But now you get into this thing, the Senate, you know, and some of it isn't pretty, right? It's like making sausage.
I have to say, it's been 6 months.
Don't you dare lie to me.
That's right. I've been pleasantly surprised about the kind of camaraderie and the number of senators who have said...
Well, camaraderie, there's never been a question in these legislatures about camaraderie. Yeah.
But, you know, the number of folks who say, hey, you know, I was first termer once and I never forget the, you know, two or three folks who put me under their wing and you know, I'd love to do that for you.
They're just trying to suck you in, Adam. Everybody knows that.
So, you know, look, the reality is that it's been great that, as you point out, some committee assignments that are incredibly important for Western Massachusetts, and it doesn't hurt having a Senate president who's from Western Massachusetts and understands those priorities. And so far, so good. And honestly, we just had a great budget.
So what's that like working with a Republican governor?
You know, my big thing is it doesn't really matter who's in the, well, it does matter, but my point is when I'm fighting for Western Mass, it's been, do they understand that it's unique, that we have unique challenges related to basic infrastructure, high-speed internet, transportation, and that it does require additional investments from the state. And so to the extent that he's listening to that argument, it's been great to work with him.
Well, Governor Baker is a Republican, if I've ever seen one.
Right.
You know, we've had Wells, Salucci, you name them, they've been governors in Massachusetts, and they get elected when the electorate gets a little frustrated with who the Democrats are offering up. I think that's a fair analysis of what happens. And then they pretty well act, Romney, of course, they pretty well act like Democrats for a while, don't they? I mean, after all, Obamacare was once called Romneycare.
Right. Look, there are things that we would welcome more noise from the corner office when it comes to the president of the country. But it is true that he's been very clear in saying that he disagrees with the current health care bill. He disagrees with the decision to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. And so there are key issues that he has been in alignment. But from a legislative perspective, there are deep concerns when it comes to things like not understanding local priorities and other things that we'll go toe-to-toe on for a while, I'm sure.
Would you like to be the governor?
I'm very happy trying to figure out what's going on in the legislature.
That's what they all say. But I mean, at night, do you ever dream? I'm the governor now. I'm sitting in the corner office.
That hasn't crossed my mind.
No?
No.
Okay, so then what is the part of the legislature that you don't like?
You know, I think the back and forth that I see between the Senate and the House on particular issues has been concerning.
Now, is the House the more conservative body in Massachusetts for our listeners to understand? Yeah,
absolutely. And so, you know, that has a big impact on things like, you know, the marijuana bill, right? So we had this passed through a state referendum, and now we're going back and forth on some pretty fundamental aspects of that, i.e. tax rates, local control, et cetera. And so I can see this. I'm seeing firsthand what I've heard about for some time, which is there's often an ability to move something ahead, but then it has to get through the other branch as well.
So what is it that makes the House of Representatives in Massachusetts, what makes them more conservative than the upper house, the Senate?
You know, it'd be interesting to look at studies. My sense is a Senate district is bigger and you can protect yourself, insulate yourself from a broader set of votes. So you can take a decision that might be popular in one area and unpopular in another area based on what you think is the right policy choice. I think in a representative seat, it's much smaller. So I think you're probably more, you know, your hands are tied a little tighter.
I've often referred to the work of the sociologist, as a sociology major you will, of course, know, Robert Michels, who talked about the iron law of oligarchy. Hmm. Now, is it true that the speaker in the House is more of a formal oligarch than the president of the Senate?
Well, by design in the Constitution, it says that money bills need to originate in the House. So I think to a large degree, there is a sense of a degree of power that comes to it with that. And then, you know, beyond that, the fact that you need to have both sides before anything can move to the governor is 101, means that there's inherently a range of power that can be wielded by either side. But quite honestly, you know, the Senate president is incredibly powerful as well in terms of pushing the agenda, pushing the narrative, pushing the dialogue.
So a lot of people from the Massachusetts legislature and the New York legislature have gone to jail for being thieves and corrupt and all the rest of that stuff. Do you ever worry when somebody comes up to you and says, Adam, here's an envelope for you, you know, in other words, when Mario Cuomo used to tell me, I never took an envelope from anybody. You just don't do it in politics. Do you ever worry that there will be people down the road who will try to corrupt you?
That is not a worry. Look, you know, you get into this with a certain idealism, a certain objective, and the concept that you would be making those decisions based on the amount of money somebody gets you or the influence that one individual has just isn't a factor.
But major lobby groups have objectives, and they want you, obviously. They need your vote. So one that's of interest to me, because I have a direct relative who has a tiny, tiny, tiny little Airbnb.
You'll be happy to hear that was not in the budget that was sent to the governor's desk.
Well, it's interesting, though, you know that the hotels and others, in fact, in Berkshire Eagle, there was an article about, I think it was Clarence Fanta who wrote it, I'm not sure. When is it too many hotels in Berkshire County? And here come people who can earn a couple of bucks extra, or for whatever reason they do it. And obviously the real estate industry, the hotel people would love not to share their largesse with the small homeowner. And they've got more clout, believe me, than the small homeowners do. Hmm. Do they? Don't they?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think I've considered that.
What?
The small homeowners are the voters, so they probably have more control, direct control in the ballot box. I mean, my sense on the Airbnb tax is I hear you. I get it that you don't want to stifle this emerging sharing economy, but I'm not convinced it does to put on a tax that municipalities can then benefit from. And Airbnb itself is saying we're interested in having
doing
these
some
taxes. Yeah. By the way, the parentheses here is that it's a bit of a trade-off, I would argue, in their mind that they think they can accept the tax and do away with increasing regulation. And so that's kind of maybe an unspoken piece to this. And so if it is the case that that stifles the development of this, then maybe we can talk. But I'm not sure I've seen that yet. And instead, it pushes it onto the consumer, the person staying over. And it feels inevitable that we're moving in this direction. You know, my millennial friends, of which I'm not one, I've just missed the cut, will say that, you know, it's uncool to stay in hotels and they just go into Airbnbs anywhere they go. And so it feels like that's the direction we're headed anyway. It's not at risk of being stifled, I don't think.
So, Adam Hines, can you take criticism? The reason I say that is it's difficult for many of us to do that. You know, and people will write mean letters to you. I probably am more of a lightning rod than you are, but I get letters from the right wing about, you know, what a communist pinko I am. And then I get letters from the left community saying, you're not strong enough, you know.
Welcome to my world.
Welcome to the world, right?
Yeah. learned pretty early to take all of that in stride, and I think it's absolutely important to take on board what the views are of folks, but,
yeah. Wait, you can take it in stride?
I mean, that's the attempt. I'm not going to lie. I still lose sleep over, you know,
an occasional letter.
Yeah, suppose. In our first 100 days, we did a kind of a, you know, by the numbers, and we had 2,300 different contacts from folks, and so there's a lot of noise, and it kind of falls into the category that you're talking about.
Well, now, you mentioned earlier that the Berkshires, for example, have huge investment in the arts, Barrington Stage and Kate McGuire and her wonderful group at the Colonial Organization, and everybody wants to get some help.
Yeah.
So they come to you, right? And they say, hey, Adam, can you help us out here?
Are you talking about in the cultural space or in general?
Well, actually, I'm talking in both.
Yeah, it is absolutely the case. And one of the things we're going to be doing with the hearing process for the Arts, Tourism, and Cultural Development Committee, as one example, the Cultural Facilities Fund that was created 10 years ago, is it fulfilling its intent?
And great question.
It is, because quite honestly, there are a lot of theaters that are struggling with just maintaining buildings, aging buildings and the like. And does the $75,000 grant here, $100,000 grant there to help with a roof repair, is that doing the job versus, okay, maybe we have to go a little bigger and they can now draw on that over time? And so I think that's what we're going to be exploring this summer. And then in general, here's what I've been focusing on in the first 6 months, is that it's easy to point to my colleagues and say, yes, you're right. You think Berkshire's, Western Mass, you think Tanglewood and the Red Lion Inn. And it is the case that we have world-class culture. It is the case that we have unequaled access to nature. That's one of the reasons I moved back. It is the case that we have an affordability that makes it a great place to raise a child. But yet we have deeply concerning trends. Population decline, median household incomes that are below the state average, education attainment is below, and on and on. And yet as we're trying to turn that corner and right the ship, we don't even have basic infrastructure, high-speed internet, transportation. And so that's been our focus of how do we make sure we have an agenda for small towns, an agenda for Western Mass that puts us on solid footing. So that's honestly where I've focused both legislatively and in the budget that we just finished.
Before we leave that, how is the money given out to various cultural institutions? So, for example, does every town have a committee, an arts committee that gives out the money?
Yeah, so the big channel is the Mass Cultural Council, which I put in an amendment to increase funding for that. It's largely flat, more or less. And then they have various programs, about a dozen or so, but a key one is working with the local cultural councils. But that's honestly, it's pennies in the big scheme of things, right? I sat in a meeting in Beckett and they said, you know, we have $1,461 that we get through this. And this is, you know, so there's a bit of a disconnect given what I just said about the lofty role of arts and culture for our economy and jobs, and then ultimately what the state spends on it.
Does it get political? I mean, in other words, I remember a time, I probably shouldn't even bring it up again, I'll just stir up the hornets, but our local cultural council in Great Barrington decided that the local radio station, I don't even know if it's still there anymore, was playing a program that one of the board members of the cultural council thought was anti-Semitic, and it may well have been. Nevertheless, Hughes decided that maybe the local radio station should not get their little tiny bit of money that was there. And I thought that was not good. So I'm wondering whether or not there are these, you know, sort of political agendas that sometimes come up in awarding grants.
Not that I've seen, but that does sound like a distinct possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about trains of all things.
Yes.
I love the idea of being able to get on a train in Great Barrington.
Tell me about it.
Go to New York.
Yeah.
Are we any closer to this?
Yes. Here's some good news, Dr. Shartok. In the budget, one of the amendments that we got in, and it passed through the conference committee, so it's on the governor's desk, is essentially saying that the current route that Massachusetts was trying, basically through Connecticut, has hit a wall. And so in the last couple of years, we've seen Massachusetts invest in purchasing the tracks. But ultimately, Connecticut has said, you know, thanks for that, but it's not in our interest. We're focusing more on the New Haven, Hartford, Springfield line and other infrastructure projects. So we compel the Department of Transportation, if it passes the governor's pen, to create a working group with New York to use existing lines. There's a track from Pittsfield to West Stockbridge and then out to south of Albany. So it connects with an Amtrak route from Albany to New York City. And so now we're talking about existing rail and a spur that is probably less than a half mile long to turn that corner to go south.
So in whose lifetime, mine or yours, will we see this?
But don't you see? It's changed the conversation. Existing tracks, and by the way, an investment that, again, going back to Professor Shepard, that has
Williams College.
Of Williams College.
How much we get Because there'll because there'll be people in the Berkshires who say, we don't want that. We don't want people getting off the train.
And I tell you, you know, so he has pointed out that, and this is 5 years ago, that train from New York to the Berkshires and back would bring over $600 million in 10 years in additional revenue. And I can't tell you how many times I have the conversation, and I'm sure you do as well in Great Barrington, that if there was easy transportation and high-speed internet, I would do my fill-in-the-blank media job from New York City based in the Berkshires or other types of jobs. And if I could reverse commute and go down once a week on a one-seat transportation, you know, mode, then I'd be much more likely to do that. And so here we are in the face of population decline, as I mentioned earlier. If we get these two ingredients right, I think we're going in the right direction.
But what about the kids? I mean, I hear from the kids, I can't afford to live here anymore. All those guys are coming up with their laptops from New York City and buying houses they used to sell for $50,000 and they're paying $600,000, and that brings up affordable housing, which is a big crisis.
It's huge, and especially in South County. It's different challenges in each part of the region, but no question that I would like to think we can have both. You know, sure, welcome the folks who are responding to the market, but making sure that we're insulating the affordability so that we don't lose folks to other areas.
Well, you know, my town of Great Barrington, which I love so much, and been named by the Smithsonian the greatest small town in America, you can't buy a pair of underwear anymore, or you can, but it's expensive underwear. Whereas a lot of banks, real estate agencies, and others are taking up the storefronts. So how do we deal with that?
Yeah, you know, I'm someone who lives in downtown housing in Pittsfield. I think that this affordable market rate housing is critical for maintaining a vibrancy downtown, creating foot traffic. And so you can have a response from, you know, grocers and others that say, okay, we want to make sure that we take advantage of that. And so that's been a big focus of ours is how do you bring together the developers, the state funding, and others in towns to try to make some progress on that. But you're putting your finger on a big one, affordable housing.
Not only affordable housing, but that, I don't know what to call it, but the Manhattanizing of the Berkshires. I mean, you walk down the Broadway in Manhattan and, you know, the old fruit stands, everything else, gone. Mm. And now one bank after another, one Duane Reade, one more drugstore.
Yeah.
And that is something I think might be of some concern to some people.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'll be the last person to say that we should find a way to cut that off. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, given everything I just said about the impact of population decline and on our local budgets and school funding and the like, it means that we are behind the eight ball. And so we better come up with a strategy that reverses that trend. And I think things like trains are one of them.
Well, Senator Adam Hines, I guess I wanted to ask you about one thing you just mentioned, and that is education. You're on the education committee. You're not the chair, but you're on the education committee. We have a lot of very...
I'm on higher education, not education.
Oh, higher education. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
But keep going to that.
Yeah. And the question is, to me, we may have too many schools for the number of students we have. I think I'm right when I tell you that when we moved to the Berkshires full-time in 1971, there were more students at one of the high schools, Monument Mountain, than there are in both of the ones, South County. And so there's a big move to try to get them to combine the various districts, but they don't want to do it because it's my territory.
Yeah. So you're putting your finger on probably the second pillar that I've been grappling with in these first 6 months. And it relates to, I'm going to tie it all together here, but it relates to school funding and what we're doing in the context of student enrollment decline. And so in my mind, we've had probably three pots of money that we felt we had to get right if we're going to save our schools, essentially. And one of them is just the Chapter 70 education funding, so increasing that. But guess what? That's based on pupil, the number of pupils you have. And so given we're having fewer students, it doesn't really help us out here. And so the second batch has been, you know, what are we doing about the foundation budget review? So the formula that's used to decide how much a town needs to put forward for their schools, there has been a commission that says, guess what? The state thinks that schools are spending 60% less than they actually are on special education. The state thinks they're spending 140% less on retiree benefits than they actually are. And so there's a need to get that right.
I'm sorry, Adam, could you sort of explain that to me? Because I'm not following.
Okay, so maybe I'll flip it and that could be easier. The schools are spending 60% more than the state is allocating to them to pay for special education.
Okay.
And so there's a big disconnect and our schools are drowning as a result. And so we planted a flag in the budget this year in the Senate that we want to spend more on special education funding for schools, just as an example. So that's a second batch. Then the third is another success we had in the budget process was an amendment for sparsity aid for our schools, essentially saying there are unique factors that these regional school districts in particular contend with. Look, my school, the one I grew up in, 250 square miles, the biggest school district in this Commonwealth. And there are inherently, you know, this inability to take advantage of, you know, economies of scale. And so we looked at other states, and Wisconsin says, you know what, we're also going to factor in this, you know, students per capita, per student density. And so that's on the governor's desk as well. All of this, by the way, transportation and education, a lot of this work in this session is saying, guess what? It's on the ballot in 2018, the Fair Share Amendment, the millionaire's tax that would increase the amount of tax that someone who makes over $1 million would pay on the amount over $1 million, and it would go up by 4%. Then that is to be spent on education and transportation. And so you can see that a strategy here is saying, what would we do out in Western Mass with those funds if it passes in November of 2018? And so I've outlined a couple, the train, sparsity aid, and additional things.
Talk to me a little bit when you have your education hat on about charter schools.
Yeah.
Now, an argument, a powerful argument has been made for charters that students in places where they have no hope should be given an option, just like rich kids can go to private school, you know, if they have to. Not all, and I'm sure I'll hear from somebody about that. Nevertheless, that's what it really is, choice. But in the Berkshires, I don't know that it makes sense. Mm. We have excellent schools, really excellent schools. My kids went to Monument Mountain, and they did extraordinarily well in life.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we need to divert needed money, the kind of thing you're talking about, from our public schools in order to give it to these so-called other public schools where somebody decides they wake up one morning, I want a charter school.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. As you mentioned, I'm the son of a public school teacher and went to a public schools myself, and I get the original intent around charters. Are there experiments that can be done that would then feed back into the public school? It has been deeply concerning looking at the numbers, particularly during the past year when we had a ballot initiative to expand the number of charter schools in Massachusetts. Looking at the number of funds that were diverted as a result from public schools was really what kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And so I think if we do it, then there's a need to ensure that the financing is done correctly, and to make sure that there isn't a siphoning off, to make sure that the lessons learned come back and down the line. And so given, I guess, my negotiation background, you won't be surprised that I would think it would be useful to make sure we're very deliberate in ensuring we achieve those goals and putting in a framework to do it.
So have you ever had to fire anybody in your role as a senator from
No.
the staff? You haven't?
It's been a whopping 6 months, and luckily I have not.
Yeah. How do you choose staff?
You know what? One of the smartest things I did was take my predecessor's Boston staff. There's three of them that I have in the Capitol, in the State House. And that was...
You look like him. You have the same staff. Anybody ever come up and realize that he hasn't gone away and
That's
you're
right.
here now?
We joked about that you know, maybe he should make an announcement that he had changed his mind and he's not retiring from the Senate, and I'd just start doing the role for him and people wouldn't even notice. But we figured that wasn't the best idea. But, you know, it was great to have the institutional memory, right? So all
sure.
my, in those first months, people, by having that staff, they could say, well, this is how it happened 5 years ago and this is the person. You know, I can't tell you how many times in a day I say to my chief of staff, I want to work on this issue and we need to get serious about that. And she said, oh, you need to talk to Jimmy over in this agency. And she knows, has a relationship. It's been great.
There's some people who have said that term limits would be appropriate because almost everybody gets reelected. And one of the objections to term limits is that the staff would begin to run everything.
Hmm. Interesting. I could see that because they are a wealth of knowledge and they work with each other behind the scenes, and that's a huge asset. So I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing to the extent that they're working on getting things done.
Adam Hines, I'm a big fan of something called initiative and referendum. Hmm. New York State has a terrible and potentially corrupt legislature, which, you know, everybody has to struggle with that kind of thing. But the idea that the voters can put something on the ballot and pass it in Massachusetts, and you can't in New York, is a huge thing. And I love that. There are people who write me all the time and say, no, you're wrong. California, they always, the rich guys always put things on the ballot that are terrible. What's been your experience or your insights into initiative and referendum in Massachusetts?
I do really like that it pushes the envelope on issues that most public servants may not, who are, you know, held to the ballot, to being elected. And so, you know, there's a I think, a range of constraints that this liberates them from. Them, I guess, us. By the way, I'll never forget that maybe a month after I was sworn in, I walked into a room and someone said, oh, the politicians are here. And I looked around and was like, who's here? Who's
where,
here?
Where?
Let's get them. So I have to stop speaking in the third person. But, you know, it's also been my experience that ballot initiatives aren't always the most elegant way for achieving, you know, good policy. And so I'll go back to the marijuana initiative where, you know, we're kind of rolling up our sleeves and saying, okay, that's great. Now, are there some fixes that make some sense while keeping in line with the intent of the voter? And that's, well, we've been very clear on that, that that's the starting point.
Well, let's stay there for a while.
Okay.
For a moment. Maybe you could parse this for us. Look, I talk to people all the time, doctors who say, no, marijuana is a gateway drug.
Hmm.
And therefore, it's a dangerous drug. Jenny Michaels from the Breen Center has, in fact, told me that. I believe her. I think she's a terrific person and a very brilliant psychiatrist. So are we doing something stupid here?
Well, it's true. You know, I'm not the scientist either. And so it's tricky. Before joining the Senate, I was working with a lot of substance abuse and substance use programs in northern Berkshire County. And it absolutely is the case that there is a shift that has been happening in kind of risk of harm and things of that perception that around youth in general around drugs, not marijuana. And so that some of those trends have been what a lot of folks are working on. I'm not convinced yet that it's a gateway drug. I think that there's a...
not for everyone, surely.
Yeah. And then there are those who would probably argue that it's a useful way to come off of harder substances. So, you know, I think at this point, what I'm grappling with is how do we implement this initiative in a way that represents what the voters want? And so the conversation has been more on taxing and local control for, you know, can the select board or city council decide that they don't want any recreational shops in their jurisdiction, or do they require a referendum of all voters in the town?
And what about driving? I mean, you know,
yeah,
we know we can test for alcohol. Are we convinced that we can test for being, you know, under the influence of marijuana?
Right. No. The answer is no right now. And then I'll add to that list edibles and the challenges around consumption.
Brownies.
There. Yeah. And how that delayed impact leads to more consumption. And so it's not without challenges and risk, but I'm not sure if that's the reason we should throw it out.
So what should we do? You know, what is Adam Hines' prescription with everything you've seen? You've seen much more than we have about this. What should we do?
Well, we've been very clear on trying to learn from other states in the first instance. Second, set a very clear baseline in monitoring all these things, watching, are we seeing more impaired driving? Are we seeing more use by youth? During the campaign, by the way, I had problems with this because of the developing brain, because the Dr. Jenny Michaels of the world were abundantly clear that the developing brain continues to develop until 24, 25, and that substances have an impact in that phase. And so, you know, I think we'll be watching those impacts very closely. On does recreational marijuana legalization have an impact on usage younger?
So with the people of Massachusetts voting yes on this, would Adam Hines, I don't know how else to put it, have the guts, if you were convinced this was detrimental, to say, okay, I think we made a bad turn here?
Yes, presumably we would have the evidence if it were to go in that direction to say there's a need for a change. It's tricky. It's a tough one.
Now, we know we are beset with a heroin epidemic.
Yeah.
Tell us about it.
So this is, in fact, one of the specific areas where we were working in North County before joining the Senate. And
what was that job there? Just for,
so I was the executive director of the Northern Berkshire Community Coalition. And so essentially, we had a lot of state contracts related to Department of Children and Families, related to substance use and interventions. And so one of the things, just as an example, one of the things that we did was we got a grant for Narcan to be available to police and first responders in North Adams. And in the first, I want to get this right, first 5 days, it was used 7 times and saved 4 lives. And that hit me over the head of saying, my God, we've got a serious epidemic here. And it has unfortunately continued at a steady clip.
What's behind it?
You know, you can point to a whole range of things. I think a lot of folks, mental health is finally being elevated to a point of being, of us recognizing that it has pervaded society. And when you look at the number of folks in our jails right now who suffer from mental health issues, the number of folks who are substance abusers. But, you know, I think this one, it's a little maybe more straightforward. We know 80%, so 4 out of 5 of current heroin users started with prescription drugs, either for, you know, recreational use or
really?
or for pain management. And so that points to the big point of where we need to intervene, i.e. the prescribers and doctors and prescription monitoring programs. And so that's been a part of our state approach, is making sure that folks can't shop and get more and more.
How do we do that?
So this is the PMP, the Prescription Monitoring Program, essentially says that each doctor, when they're prescribing, has a record in front of them of where the person in front of them has gone and what they've been prescribed elsewhere. And so putting more money into that to make sure that that's available in pharmacies, in doctor's offices, et cetera.
Do we think that the doctors are prescribing less as a result of this?
Anecdotally, there has been a shift from pain reduction to, wait a second, this has implications. And so the awareness, I think, has grown, I think. And we've seen that medical schools are also incorporating this instruction in their curriculum as well.
Huh. It doesn't seem to be getting better, however.
No.
Is this a national malaise that we're dealing with here? You think we could lay this off on Trump, or has this been going on in the Obama years too?
As much as I would like to lay it at Trump's feet, I think it's been going on for years and years. And as you point out, it's not getting better. And so I often think of it as a three-pronged approach. One is that prevention side that we just mentioned with prescription drugs, and then the intervention and harm reduction related to the Narcan, related to, you know, recovery coaches, and finally treatment and recovery, and making sure we have all the beds that are needed throughout the region to ensure that folks get the help when they want the help.
You have to go from Pittsfield to Boston. How many days a week?
I typically go down for 2 days a week, caucus and formal sessions.
Right. And that's a hell of a drive, right?
Yeah.
About 2.5 hours.
2.5 each way, right. And then if I leave after 3 o'clock coming west, then it could be a 3.5. It adds an hour. So nobody wants automated vehicles more than this guy.
Yeah, that'd be something, wouldn't it? Do you think they're coming?
I do. You know, we often talk about the fact that there's been, just looking at taxis, we had taxi regulation in place for 100 years. Suddenly we had this thing called, you know, Uber and Lyft on demand, and we had to change the regulations. The ink hadn't dried on that.
And I take it the taxi people came to see you and tried to talk to you.
Well, luckily that was done before I got in there, so nobody cared what I thought at that point.
Yeah.
And then now all of a sudden we're talking about, and we're having hearings on regulation related to automated vehicles. And so I do think that is a likely scenario soon.
Well, so you get in your car and you say, take me to Boston, but here's what you don't do. You don't listen to the radio, which is what saved FM radio cars, because you'll be turning around, swiveling around, and watching TV.
And dumb, doing work.
Dumb TV or doing work. That's right.
Are you lobbying me?
No.
Oh.
I don't think it's savable. I think we're going to have automatic vehicles, as you indicate, and coming over from Great Barrington to Albany every day, take me to Albany. Yeah, you know.
It's interesting.
We'll do it. Of course, there's always the margin for problems. So for example, as long as we have anybody behind a wheel, there'll be crashes.
Yeah. By the way, people often bring this up when I say we need to fight for trains, east-west trains as well, so Boston to Albany.
Yeah.
And people will say, why would we do such a large investment at a moment when we might have automated vehicles? And I disagree. I think that ecologically and otherwise, there's still an argument, even though we'll be moving to electric vehicles as well, I think, inevitably. And so to be continued, I guess, on that.
I just saw an article in the New York Times which said that the governors of several states in the age of Trump have decided that really the way to go now is for each state to do environmental rules of its own, and the hell with Trump.
The silver lining to the Paris announcement, and it is deeply concerning, so I'm really reaching for this one, but you know, I had three priorities in mind right afterwards. One is we needed to signal immediately to the international communities, particularly the India and China, who at the time I think we were all thinking, well, India may not be so solid on this agreement in the first instance. We wanted to signal very strongly that, you know what, the states have been a leader on environmental policy for a long time, and the commitments are significant. And so that's why I was glad that Governor Baker joined New York and California in those hours after the announcement to say, well, actually, we're forming the U.S. Climate Alliance and we remain strong. The second piece has been, and this is where the international background has been helpful as well, another unanticipated area, and being able to pick up the phone and talk to the UNFCCC, the framework behind Paris, and say, hey, you know, what is it that we can do at the subnational level? And the answer is we can organize and try to ensure that our own commitments at the state level are measured and reported. And there are mechanisms to do that. We can't replace the federal commitments. Let's not forget that we're in this until the day after the election. And we need to hold the federal level to account, but we can certainly supplement that and push each other at the state level. And then finally, the third category is where would we increase our own commitments, renewable portfolio standards for our utilities and other ways that we should double down.
Adam Hines, talk to me about crime. The Massachusetts legislature, I know, is taking up this in a big way. There are some people who think that the answer is going to be to make prison time less, to be more like West Side Story, where they sang Officer Krupke, to be more like social workers. But if somebody, you know, fires a gun or somebody holds up a store or something, do we really want to go in the other direction of making things more lenient? I ask that as a provocative question, not because I necessarily believe it.
Okay, good. Well, your timing is great because the Massachusetts Senate and the legislature will be taking up criminal justice reform in the fall.
Right.
And so we just had, a Senate retreat last week. And I think it's another, again, example of where the states often need to lead the national discussion. And we've seen the tensions in the last couple of years increase. So to my perspective, and by the way, this is based on when I first came back, starting something called Pittsfield Community Connection, working with high-risk youth, gang-involved youth in some cases, and trying to unpack where are we headed as a society and how are we addressing this. I think the common ground right now is clearly in recidivism and reducing our high rates of recidivism. So somebody gets out of jail and suddenly they don't have a job, they may not have transportation, and they're right back in the same environment. And before you know it, they're conducting the same crimes and back in jail. Nobody benefits from that. All sides can agree that that's something that we need to invest in, whether it's mental health counseling or job training, et cetera. We all win. My concern right now is that there's so much distrust in the justice system right now. That when we have a shooting we had a shooting while I was working on this program in Pittsfield, and you see firsthand the DAs and the police, they're doing critical work in the hours and days that follow, and yet we still don't have cases cleared. They don't end in an arrest. Nobody comes forward. And so the police chief and others say, our biggest problem is we know there are witnesses. Nobody wants to say anything. Either because you're going to see the same guy who committed the crime walking around the streets, or you don't want to be seen as a narc, you know, you don't have a good relationship with the local police officers. So that is undermining our ability to keep the community safe. And so that's, I think, another piece of common ground that we need to get at. And how do you send that signal that things are changing? My view is that, you know, mandatory minimums for nonviolent drug offenses is one of those areas. You get rid of that. It's one area where we can say very clearly things are shifting, and this is either a substance abuse issue or an economic development issue in those cases. And by the way, I'm putting aside, you know, some of the other charges that often go along with it that could be more severe. And I think it's through those steps and serious investment in ensuring folks have the ability to get a job afterwards, that's where we start to turn a corner. I've been deeply concerned when you look at the overlap of poverty and areas with high crime rates. And so to me, it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Don't you think that when people hear you say that kind of thing, that they're going to say Hines is soft on crime?
Except my point that, you know, police cannot do their job when they can't get anybody to talk and go along with giving information that they have. So this is all about how do you have them more effective? And the current distrust is not conducive to that.
So tell me about Pittsfield a little bit. You live there. It's a beautiful little town. I mean, it has a beautiful lake. It has mountains over it. And yet it is beset with a lot of criminal activity. And when you've been talking about making, you know, the public trust greater, it really has to do, though, with drug gangs having moved up from New York and into Pittsfield, doesn't it?
You know, my awareness of that shifted. I think that that was certainly a trend in years past. But now I think we've seen plenty of folks who have grown up in the area also going down that route. But I do want to make a point that it's all relative, right? So yes, there is crime and it's deeply concerning, but it's all relative in terms of numbers. But it is a concern. And again, I want to get back to the point that the kids that we were dealing with, the narrative was often, you know, the odds are stacked against these guys really from the womb. I mean, when we're talking about fetal alcohol syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, we know impacts behavior management processes in the brain. And so we're talking about having an impact from that stage forward. And then, you know, when we would get to them at 14, it was way too late. We know that when you're, for example, you know, if you're behind reading level by grade 3, your chances of facing jail time at some point in your life dramatically go up. And so when those fundamentals aren't even in place, we shouldn't be surprised that there are youth who are acting out. And so those dynamics combined with challenging economy and getting those building blocks in place, that's what we need to get right.
So you're optimistic?
Yes.
You are?
I am. for a whole range of reasons. I mean, the fact that we're talking about it and identifying the problem and then mobilizing as communities, that's critical.
When you look at your own career, you're a very young man still. Where do you want to go?
You know, I mean,
you're very bright, and you're a real bright light for all of us to watch. And people are really sort of proud of you.
Thanks for saying that. Being
our guy up there. But Massachusetts State Senate is a place you want to be for the rest of your life, or you want to go somewhere else?
Well, you know, I started talking about my uncle, and he found that, you know, government wasn't where he was going to make his difference. He made a career on starting an organization that was taking on, at the time, the newly minted civil rights legislation and deciding that, you know, we wanted to take on folks who were redlining folks in real estate or taking other measures. And he thought that the legislature would be the place to continue that work and do it at a higher and more meaningful level. He ultimately left after two terms because it didn't fit. So I'm 6 months in. I'm willing to see what this is all about and to see if it fits with being, you know, having an impact and improving the lives of folks around you.
Well, I remember once local school superintendent took Roselle and I to a meeting to meet this young man in the legislature in the House who was going to run for governor. And we said, oh, come on. Because my experience had been in New York where, you know, guys in the legislature don't run, not in, certain senators do, but not for reps. And it was Michael Dukakis. And
you got that one right.
Of course he won. So Massachusetts is a different state from New York. I'm always interested in that we do things differently.
Yeah, it's true. And I guess you put your finger on a couple of them, but it's different histories. Although I hate to overstate this, and I guess you're the best example. You know, you have that political line when you're facing one side, you're looking in that direction. When you step your foot over the other side, you look the other direction often. And WAMC, I'm not just saying this because I'm in the room with you, I think has been key in recognizing that this is a regional approach to how we do well together. And it's gone great lengths to achieving that, I think, making sure we're all in it together.
And yet in Western Massachusetts, where you live, I agree with you. I think we do a very good job. We have two bureau chiefs over in Massachusetts who do this work. But not everybody does. And we have television stations.
Yes.
And people think that Andrew Cuomo is their governor.
Yeah. So, okay, well, if you want to go there, thank you, because this is the narrative that I contend with every day in my job, which is we don't even watch Boston News. We know more about Albany than we do Boston. We're closer to Albany. And boy, if you want to talk about difficult constituency relations, wait till somebody sits down to watch the Patriots and it's the Jets. My God. And so we're already working on that and trying to take the appeal to their humanity for some of the cable companies and just their civic engagement so that they can understand the importance of working with Boston. And if not, then I might have to escalate it. But this has gone on way too long. Unfortunately, it's a federal issue in the media markets. And we pay the price, including my ability to talk to constituents, right, and tell them what we're up to because they're not watching.
They have no
idea. Yeah.
Well, I think that's true in New York State, even with all the television. Nobody knows a thing about the legislature. It's really
fair enough.
Something that's not good. However, I am fascinated by the cultural difference. You get in a car and you cross over from New York State into Massachusetts, and you know the minute you cross over, you're in a different place.
Hmm.
What is it? Is it the road signs? Is it the way the highways exist?
I have this. There was this one moment I was in, I don't like to talk about the international stuff too much, but this is relevant. I was in northwest Iraq traveling from basically in near Mosul in a Jeep and traveling from the border of Syria towards a compound of a sheikh. And somebody announced, we're going to Sinjar. And somebody announced, oh, we just switched to the, Abdullah tribe. And I said, there wasn't any signs or anything. Oh, the sand just changed. Sure.
But it is amazing, isn't it, that there is a different absolute, forget about the radio or anything else. You just go from New York to Massachusetts and you say, boy, there's a difference here.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the road markings or what.
Let's explore that sometime. I'm curious because I know what you're putting your finger on.
Of course, most people do.
Yeah.
So have you ever played a musical instrument?
Drums in high school, in elementary school and high school.
And you gave them up?
I still have a kit, a drum set, and some of my friends threatened to pull me up in one of their shows, the Whiskey Treaty and others. So to be continued. And I have a guitar that sits in the corner that I play once a month and can't manage more.
Right, right, right. So it must be something to be in the neighborhood of Tanglewood. And they must love it when you come by. I know they're very aware. So that leads to the last question I have for you. Now you're Senator Hines. How do you keep your ego in control? You don't show any signs of it, by the way. But how do you keep your ego when people say Senator, Senator, Senator to you? I mean, you know.
Well, I guess, first of all, you'd have to think that that's a big deal in itself. So I'm just trying to do the job. And people like you keep me in check. That's for sure.
Not at all. You know, I'm a huge fan. And I think when you get a fairly young man who obviously has a brilliant future in front of him, and he runs for a political office like this and is making the kinds of sensible moves that you are, I just think it's extraordinary, and we have to support what we have here. Thank you so much for doing it. Our guest has been Adam Hines, who is, of course, a state senator from the Berkshires and from many other places besides the Berkshires, Hampshire, Franklin, and Hamden counties, and a guy who's a fast mover and been recognized for that. We are out of time. We've been talking to Massachusetts State Senator Adam Hines. Adam, thank you so much for taking all this time and being here with us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.